right, the next case on our calendar this morning is TGG versus HES. And counsel, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments. I should note for the record that this matter will be recorded, so please keep in mind the confidentiality concerns raised by this case and refer to the appellant as father. I think that would be sufficient. And of course, the child is child. And with that understanding, we may begin.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Kaynord Hunt, and I represent the appellant TGG, which I will refer to in this argument as father. Father seeks to establish a parent-child relationship with his child. Throughout, father has expressed his willingness to provide financial and physical support for the child, which included his expressed desire, as stated in his communication with respondent HES, who I will refer to as mother, before bringing this action, which are attached as Exhibit 4 to his complaint. Father therein explains to mother he is prepared to take care of the two-month-old child, and as expressed in his pleadings, he seeks full custody of the child. Father is not seeking to merely block adoption by others. Instead, he has pledged full custody of the child. Even though this paternity action was brought before the adoption petition was filed, the trial court has ruled that father can have no relationship with child and has declared that father has abandoned his child. Now,
does this present a matter of first impression?
It does, Your Honor. It does, and that's why in a number of respects. And first, I would like to talk a little bit about the recognition of parentage piece of it and then go on from there. Now, the fact is that father and mother filed a recognition of parentage, which was in place when the court issued an injunction, which precluded any adoption from going forward and certainly without his consent. There's no question that father is child's biological parent, and the recognition of parentage that mother and father signed under oath and filed states and acknowledged that they are child's biological parents and wish to be recognized as such. Now, the purpose
of... But you do acknowledge, though, that mother could certainly rescind that.
Well, the question is whether she could do so in the face of the injunction that had issued. So what had happened is there was an injunction issued by the trial court. An injunction maintains the status quo when the action is pending, which includes precluding any adoption from going forward and without father's consent. So here we have the injunction in place, and then mother seeks to revoke, and her statement as to why she was revoking was to enable the adoption to proceed. So
those are two separate issues, the adoption and the recognition of parenthood.
Correct, but the fact is that by revoking, she revoked it in order to allow the adoption to proceed, which is the injunction was the purpose was just to maintain status quo, which the status quo at that point was the signed recognition of parentage. So it is our position that you could not act contrary to that injunction, and therefore mother could not vacate the recognition of parentage, and therefore any adoption proceeding requires father's consent.
But you aren't disputing the fact that mother did have the right to revoke the role.
I am disputing
it. I mean, generally, the mother in a case, I'm talking generally, a mother would have the right to do that.
The statute says that, yes. But the problem here is she's doing so in the face of this injunction order.
But you're trying to tie the two together, and doesn't matter the reason why mother is trying to. And I'm take a step back. I'm trying to follow with Judge Hooten and kind of the big picture. Does it matter why mother would, the reasoning why mother would want to revoke The ROP?
Yes.
Why?
In the face of the injunction, yes.
No, no, I understand that, but I'm just talking about generally.
Generally, the statute doesn't state anything about that.
Okay.
But I think it does make a difference when we're sitting with an injunction and what the legal effect of the rope is.
I want to ask you, because I know that there was a lot of discussion about whether there was a hearing
right.
in conjunction with this temporary injunction. And as I understand it, the complaint, the paternity petition, I guess, was filed at the same time as this motion. And according to what I've picked up, it was filed on, it looks like a Friday afternoon. And then on Monday, there was an order granting the injunction. Am I correct on that?
I don't know the Friday-Monday dates, but it was, I believe it was like the 23rd, and then it was signed on the 26th of March, is my recollection.
All right. I just want to understand, was there, I mean, other than the submissions, was there any kind of hearing whatsoever?
It is
any kind of proceeding, I should say.
There was no oral argument.
So it was strictly based on the submission of paperwork.
On the paperwork. Right. And so the question then is a submission of paperwork resulting in an order, does that constitute a hearing? And we've cited to the court a case and actually a treatise where in common parlance now a hearing doesn't require that you hear with your ears. But it includes paper proceeding. So it is on that grounds that we assert that there was a hearing, and the statute provides that, you know, once you have a hearing, you can no longer revoke the rope. And so the revocation occurred after the injunction hearing.
And I think, I mean, the statute obviously makes it harder for the mom to revoke if there's been a hearing.
Right.
But that's going to be a key issue here. And again, our role is to interpret these statutes to make it work, not only for this case, but for future cases. Do we run the risk if we decide that this was not a hearing, or let's say we adopt your position that it is a hearing, and that all a father would have to do is file his petition and bring an immediate injunction. Would that, in effect, gut the scheme that's provided for the legislature for a revocation?
No, I don't think
that's all it takes.
I don't think so. I mean, this is a somewhat unusual situation. And I don't think that it would. And I think the fact that if you do come in with a paternity action before an adoption petition is filed and there is a rope and the mother seeking to vacate, that you can seek an injunction and that should be a hearing, you know, when the court decides it. I mean, we're just looking at these facts. I think that's a hearing.
But if this is an issue of first impression, and we're talking about interpretation of a statute, and part of that interpretation is what does the word hearing mean, it troubles me to have such a broad interpretation of hearing. And I mean, my concern is how that interpretation of the word hearing could be applied in other cases, too, where all of a sudden anything where documents are submitted just on paper record, and especially if they're just submitted by one party, how that is considered to be a hearing. That seems to be an awfully broad interpretation of the word that I'm not sure case law really supports that.
And case law does support it. I mean, I've cited where the courts have held that where you have a submission on papers where the court is presented with argument and is asked to make a decision, that's a hearing. I mean, if we're talking, are we defining hearing now where you have to have oral argument? I mean, I don't see that is a prerequisite to a hearing. So that's why the courts have said and looked at, you know, that you can have what we call paper hearings. without oral arguments. So, and the legislature used the word judicial or administrative hearing, and, you know, administrative hearing, as I think everybody acknowledged, is pretty broad. So I think that we fall within hearing, within the meaning here. If the court disagrees with the position, then we move on to MnStat 259.52 subdivision 8 that states that the putative father is barred thereafter from bringing or maintaining an action to assert any interest in the child during the pending adoption proceeding. Now, this action was commenced on March 23rd. At the time father initiated the paternity action, there was no pending adoption proceeding, which was commenced on April 19th, 2018, by the filing of the adoption petition.
And just to be clear, when you're going down that path in terms of interpreting that statute, are you saying that even if we don't adopt your interpretation of hearing being so broad, that you still would prevail under the statute?
Right. So
and why is that?
Because what I'm arguing is that even if there isn't this rope in place, that because the paternity action was filed before the adoption petition was filed, the question then gets to the subdivision 8 of 259.52, whether the father is barred from bringing or maintaining an action to assert any interest in the child during the pending adoption proceeding. And in that particular section, we're looking at two words, or the trial court did, pending and maintaining. I think the pending is easy, that the pending is that you have to have an adoption petition filed to have a pending adoption proceeding. The more difficult issue is in the legislature's use of the word maintaining, or to maintain. Now, I presented to the court where the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that the word maintain, when you're talking in the context of a legal action, means to commence or to file. So, therefore, using that language, since the paternity action was commenced or filed before there was a pending adoption proceeding, that this action should be allowed to go forward. Now, if the court disagrees with that analysis, then we get into the constitutional issue, which is an issue of first impression.
And before we get to the constitutional issue, so I want to go back to the maintaining part. Would you agree, though, is your position that that term is ambiguous then?
Yes.
Okay. And because it can have two meanings. It can maintain in terms of something that's filed and then you're continuing or maintaining that
right.
action. Or your argument is that maintaining is an alternative way of describing bringing.
To commence, to initiate, yes.
Bringing or maintaining means you're starting the action.
Right. And it's important because with an ambiguous term like maintain, and then you've got this whole constitutional due process sitting out there, that if you agree with our assertion that maintain means to commence or initiate, then there's not a problem with the constitutional issue, because then this paternity action can go forward. So maintain really, you know, is key when you're looking at how this is going to fall into, how you're going to analyze it, and whether you need to go to the constitutional due process issue and equal protection issue that we've raised to this court. Now, the court had asked whether that this was an issue of first impression, and it is, because we have the 2002, and I don't know how to pronounce it, Hedebretter decision. And what's interesting about that, it's a 4-3 decision. And in that case, there was a pending adoption petition before the father brought the paternity action. So the Supreme Court wasn't faced with the situation here. And a lot of the analysis in the Hedebretter case is the Supreme Court focuses on the fact that the father really didn't want full custody of the child, that the facts were equally that he's just trying to block adoption. And the court talks about that in the body and in the footnotes. But here we have a situation unequivocally where father wants custody of the child. This is not about seeking just to block an adoption.
The only thing, that case, doesn't that cut against your case to some extent because he was one day late and had a breath? Basically the Supreme Court said, we interpret the statute the way it's written. And it says 30 days, and 30 days does not mean 31 days. I mean, which seems to me kind of a harsh result, but it was certainly a statement of legislative intent.
But the Supreme Court, in looking at the due process piece of it, looked at the fact that there were things that, and I see my time's up, that father could do, that father wasn't coming in full force wanting custody of the child, that and it was a situation, like I said, where the adoption petition was pending before father brought the paternity action. We have the reverse here, where father has been proactive and wants a relationship with his child. So we ask for reversal.
All right. Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Fidler. I represent the respondent adoptive parents. And also here with me is my colleague, Jody DeSmit. She represents the mother. And I'll be making the argument for our respective parties. And first of all, I apologize. I have a cold. And so my voice is maybe one or two octaves lower than usual. I usually am not so frog-like. I just wanted to draw the court's attention to some salient and relevant facts. January 12th, a little over a year ago, 2018, the child was born. January 14th, the agency signed an adoptive placement agreement, an arm of the state, a licensed child placing agency, Bethany Christian Services, signed a placement agreement, and the child was placed for adoption by the agency. February 12th, because of the January 12th birth date, February 12th was the deadline for the father to register on the father's adoption registry. February 18th still doesn't do anything except seek a DNA test to see if he is the father. March 5, DNA test confirms he's a genetic father. March 7, mother signs a consent to adopt.
We talked about the Heidecker case. I'm sorry.
Heidbreder
case. And this is clearly distinguishable factually, right, in this case, because here we have a father that's very unequivocal. He wants to be the father of this child. He wants full custody. I mean, he's done everything he can do, albeit it's late under the statute, but it's not the same situation factually. I mean, I think we have to look at this.
Yeah, I think legally the
to him in terms right. of the factual context for bringing the statutory appeal.
No, I understand, Your Honor. And so the point about Heidbreder is that you had a father who was living in Iowa, and he had an action going on in another state. So he had the wherewithal and the desire to seek custody and paternity. So he filed a paternity action. He registered 31 days in another state. And so if anything speaks to a sense of urgency, it would have been the father's situation in the Heidbreder case. And so the Supreme Court did adopt a test. The ultimate test that comes from Lehrer versus Robertson, that's the granddaddy of cases that upholds the constitutionality of, in that case, it was a New York registry. So the Supreme Court said rights don't spring from biology alone. They spring from the full assumption of responsibility. And so the Supreme Court applied that test. It didn't depend on whether an adoption proceeding was pending. It was, so do you have rights to, did you not have a duty to register in time? So did you otherwise, were you entitled to notice? And he was not. He did
but,
not.
But we still have facts that are, even given that, well, first of all, in terms of that case, as appellant's attorney pointed out at the beginning, father's come forward and said, hey, I want to have full custody. I want to take care of this child. He left the state he was in after college, and he actually moved back to Minnesota. So we do have actions that, looking at the facts in light most favorable to him, indicate he is interested in being the parent of this child. Second, in terms of the Heidelberger case, it's not only factually different, the time frame and the issues are different. It does seem we have the reverse here, because on March 23rd is when he filed a paternity action and the temporary seeking a temporary injunction, which indeed was granted. And that all occurred before the adoption petition was filed. And you highlight some of the actions that were taken beforehand, but seems to me that goes to the word of the interpretation of the word pending. And pending seems to, case law seems to indicate you want to have a bright line rule there. And when pending starts, when that time clock starts, seems to be when that adoption action is filed.
Well, it's important to note that the record, unfortunately, wasn't clear. I did verify when the mother was served with the temporary injunction. So she signed the recognition of parentage on March 28th. The service of process, and that is in the record, the process server says she wasn't served until the next day. So she revoked her consent before she even knew that there was a temporary injunction. Furthermore, the temporary...
Well, it doesn't matter whether or not she knew that there was a temporary injunction in place. The fact of the matter is the district court issued one, so it was in place.
Right, but even on that score, it wasn't a stay of everything going on. First of all, my clients were not party to that proceeding. We obviously went ahead and proceeded to file an adoption
petition.
Right,
but it did explicitly highlight that adoption would not, any adoption proceeding would not take place with the TR.
Right, and nothing the mother did made an adoption take place. It said, you can't adopt while this case is going on.
Well, would you concede, though, if she hadn't revoked the ROP, that the father could have proceeded with his paternity action?
No, because two reasons. The statute is, I think it's very clear. The statute says, subdivision 8, and that's repeated in subdivision 10, that if you don't register within 30 days of birth, you are barred from bringing or maintaining paternity action during the pending adoption proceeding. And also says asserting any interest.
But that assumes that there is a pending adoption proceeding, though. The argument
right.
is assuming.
Right. And so you could look at this three ways, Your Honor. So you could say pending. Okay, the word is amenable to different interpretations. Does it mean like going on right now or anticipated? I concede that.
Okay, but if we follow your logic on, at some point it's going to, how do we draw that line of what action you referred to, all these activities in January, but at one point do the parties look at it and say, okay, yes, there is a quote-unquote pending action. It seems to me the only logical way you can interpret that, the only common sense way to interpret that, is when an adoption petition is filed.
Well, Your Honor, I think what we're doing is assuming that proceeding means a judicial proceeding, and there are administrative proceedings. The agency is an arm of the state, and they are licensed by DHS to make legal placements, and that's what they did. So, likewise, in the, I think the case is called Richardson, it's dealing with whether an ROP was properly filed. And this court made a point of saying this is a proceeding, even though it was not in court. It was in an administrative proceeding. It was in the Department of Health.
Right, but you're talking about a pending adoption proceeding. So I guess my question to you is if we were to adopt your interpretation of the word proceeding and you adopt your interpretation of the word pending, how is any court supposed to know when that clock starts ticking? And more importantly, when are parties supposed to know when that clock starts ticking?
Well, the mother knows when she signs her adoptive placement agreement.
Okay, how's the father supposed to know that?
Well, the father, the whole predicate of the statute under Minnesota Father's Adoption Registry is you don't get notification of anything until you register within 30 days of birth. So the father doesn't have to know. And so the problem as a father is if you've not stepped forward and assumed responsibility, as the Supreme Court said in Lair, you proceed at your own peril. So if there is an adoption pending, you will never know about it. And I will tell the court, my colleague and I, we do almost all adoption. Most times the father never knows, and that's the predicate of the whole statute. To get notice, you got to do something. You've got to register.
But there's an exception, though, if there's been an ROP signed.
Right. And so the question is, so the statute is, I think it's pretty unambiguous. It says subdivision 8, what happens when you fail to register within 30 days? You're barred thereafter. After what? After failing to register. The thereafter is crystal clear. At the 30th day, you cannot bring or maintain any action to assert any interest. That is sweeping language. And even if you don't accept the argument that it's pending, it is certainly maintaining an action.
Before we go there, and I do want to go there, I want to follow up on Judge Hooten's comment about the exceptions, because the very first part of that statute talks about except for a putative father who is entitled to notice and consent under, and lists some of the exceptions. Isn't one of those exceptions an ROP?
Right.
Okay, so the language under subdivision 1 that you're referring to is accepted out of if you have an ROP filed, correct?
No, so you have to figure out, so the statute's tied in with who gets notice.
Right.
And so are you subject to the registry or not? And so all the notice rights that you get depend on assuming responsibility, and so as of the 30th day. So that's why that word thereafter is so critical. When do you determine, has the father stepped forward? You determine it 30 days. It's a bright line test. It reaches a definitely firm, some would say harsh result, but that is the bright line test that the court used.
Right, in the issue of some would say harsh to who?
Harsh to a father is not assumed responsibility.
Well, what is it to the child if you go the other way? Isn't that harsh to a child who's going to have an attachment interrupted?
By disrupting a secure adoptive placement. Right. Yes, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court, if you read the Heidbreder case, you'll note that they used the word, the purpose of the registry is to protect placements. And it wasn't tied to the filing of an adoption petition. So counsel has said, well, maintaining, she cites the Supreme Court case, that maintaining really means bringing. And so two responses to that. Garner disagrees. He says in this construction, maintain is not synonymous with begin or institute.
Well, Garner's just, at most, is persuasive authority. It's not even case law.
Well, I think he's pretty persuasive, but in any event, bring or maintain. She's basically saying that this is like a legal alliteration, like cease and desist. But so that interpretation, what it does, unfortunately, is it makes the word maintain surplusage because it's saying it's the same thing as bring. And so I was curious where this language came from. And just for background, so I was working with a colleague of Mr. Deeble of Mr. Smith's, and we drafted the registry, and it was modeled after the Illinois Father's Adoption Registry. And so this language, bring or maintain, so that where does that come from? And so I did a Westlaw search, and I would suggest your clerks do the same, and look, where does that language come from, and what does it mean? And it's a common convention used to do two things. And it's very clear when you look at, there were over 40 citations that I found. There were too many to cite. So bring or maintain means you can't initiate it, and then if you initiate it, you can't maintain it. So you can't say as a defense, well, I already brought it. So it says you can't use it to defeat a Rule 12 motion like we did here. So that's, I think, very clear evidence that the legislature wanted to have a bright line rule at 30 days. And if you make an exception for an ROP, why not make an exception for any of the other notice provisions? What if the mother, even after signing an irrevocable consent, the consent's irrevocable, what if she went to the health department and said, I'm going to put the father on the birth certificate? So the same logic would apply. The registry wouldn't cut her off. He'd have the right to notice. What if he started paying support at day 31 or day 40 or here day 70, when there has been no support offered by the father in this case? What if that assumption of responsibility is paying support, signing an ROP, put on the birth certificate, what if she moved back in with the mother? Why, under the same logic, we would have to give notice because it fell within an exception. And what it would do is if the Court of Appeals does not affirm the case below, it will just send tremors through the adoption community. It'll disrupt placements and would be a bad thing.
But
Now my time is up.
I want to ask you one question, though. What, I mean, we have to figure out what the legislative intent was, this statutory scheme. And if there is an exception to the bar of the father's registry, but that, you know, the existence of a rope, it would be the legislative intent in allowing the mother to revoke, have the ability to revoke that rope under statute. I mean, I'm trying to understand how the whole scheme works together, because it's saying that there can be the existence of a rope, but the mother can make that rope non-existent.
Right.
Therefore, there being no.
Well, the rope is a very powerful thing because it creates a conclusion of it's conclusive as to paternity, and it does all that without any hearing whatsoever. And I think what it's doing is saying, okay, you have 60 days, and by the way, if there's an injunction, the clock's ticking, and maybe you lose your right to revoke because of an injunction. Council doesn't talk about that, but because there's no hearing, the mother has to have the right to revoke. And there's one other line of inquiry, and in some of the other states, Minnesota hasn't developed this law, but for fathers who are truly thwarted, you know, if they've tried to pay paternity or pay child support, bring over diapers, go to doctor's visits, the works, they call that, and the father and the mother then decides to not notify him and say you've abandoned the child. The father has the right to say it's called a thwarted father. So in other words, there are scenarios under Heidbreder where a father could have met that test of full assumption of responsibility, and due process should prohibit a finding of abandonment. Those facts do not exist in this case. So thank you.
Thank you.
If I may ask one more.
I guess that you have another question, and we're going to give you a little extra time, too.
Just a quick question. I wanted to, you didn't talk about 25952 subdivision 6. Why doesn't that, with Peter Father, who has signed a rope, why doesn't that take that father out of the 30-day deadline requirement?
Because in our interpretation, he didn't do it before the 30 days from birth.
That's a circular argument, though. Why doesn't that subdivision 6 take the putative father out of that 30-day requirement? Under the language of
Well, it applies, the limitation applies to fathers not entitled to notice and consent.
But
and you're not entitled to notice and consent if you didn't do your ROP within 30 days or file a paternity action within 30 days.
Under subdivision 6?
Subdivision 6 references you back to the person's entitled to notice and consent.
Right, but it starts out saying any putative father may register with the Minnesota Father's Adoptive Registry.
Oh, yes. There is a definition of putative father, so it's saying who can use this registry. And it generally, if you have to go back to the definition section, and it means a father who's unwed and is saying, I'm the father. It was not meant to be a definition of who has the right to register at any point in time.
Isn't a father who signs a recognition of parenthood, isn't that a putative father?
Oh, indeed. He's still a putative father, whether he signs an ROP or not.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
Respondent brought up the Illinois statute. If the court is going to look at the Illinois statute, I ask that the court look at the Illinois Supreme Court case of JSA versus MH. Unfortunately, I don't have the Northeast Second site, but it's at 224 Illinois Second 182, which the Illinois Supreme Court, as I read that decision, decided in a way favorable to father's position with a statute which respondent has asserted is similar to that of Minnesota's. Going back to the Heidebreder case, I mean, it's very clear in the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision that they're talking about a actual adoption petition was filed. I mean, it's stated factually. There isn't any issue to that. And there's really a problem if you're going to use pending to be something other than the filing of the petition, because actually the interveners and the mother don't actually even agree when it's pending. I mean, they have different arguments as to one is the placement, one is when the background study's done, whereas pending, where you actually file the petition, is a bright line rule. And I think that, you know, appears to be clearly what the legislature wanted in that context. In Heidebreder, what's also interesting looking at the court's decision, I mean, it talks about the record is void of any evidence that Heidebreder provided or attempted to provide financial support to Carton during her pregnancy. What's interesting is they were living together during her pregnancy, and the Supreme Court mentions in its facts that he didn't provide any, you know, with the doctors or anything else. Here we have a situation where father is told by mother that she's on birth control and that she was intimate with somebody after him. So, I mean, you know, there isn't the situation like Heidebreder where there is this relationship. But father has tried to get a relationship. He did the best he could. They talk about paying child support to whom, you know, in this situation.
You have a number of really good arguments, you know. I mean, both sides have good arguments as to, you know, the equities of the situation. But unfortunately, we've got the statutory scheme we have to interpret. And now counsel's made a big point of saying that the paternity action had to be brought within 30 days, the ROP had to be filed within 30 days. I mean, if we could just stick to the statutory interpretation, because that's what we're going to end up doing.
Well, there's two points. One, I mean, if you disagree with us on the statutory interpretation, you must go to the constitutional issue.
Okay.
Because there is a due process issue here. And I think that if you get to that point, You know, it may
be a due process issue on any 30-day notice
registry
issue?
There would be a due process arguably on any 30-day notice, but it's different here because you have the fact that you have the paternity action, which was brought before the adoption petition was filed. You also have the due process, which was the Supreme Court was really bound up with, not so much the one-day period, but the fact of what this putative father had not done for the mother, and that really was just trying to stop an adoption versus really wanting to have custody of the child. And that was really the focus of the Minnesota Supreme Court under its due process analysis. And that's why, factually, the facts here are so important, because that's not the situation. Going back to the statute does not state that the rope must be filed within the 30 days. It doesn't say that. And so you have the situation where you have the rope that is filed, and it's filed in the face of an injunction, and it's filed, I mean, you talk about this, you know, taking away the placement of the child, but we're talking early on.
Okay, then let's get to the revocation, because, I mean, let's assume we accept everything you're arguing now, but what about the revocation? I mean, the statute clearly allows the mom to revoke it.
Right, but can she revoke it in the face of an injunction order, which is to maintain the status quo, which the status quo is that you have the rope adjudicating, I mean, they're the biological parents.
What? I guess in trying to come up with the legislative intent, why would they allow the mother this control? I mean, basically it gives the mother, after 30 days, that mom is in full control because she can revoke that rope for any reason at any time.
You know, and I don't know.
That's what I'm trying to understand from the statutory scheme.
And all I can say is, I mean, it would seem to be the idea that maybe that, you know, they thought, you know, the father was a biological father and he's not. I mean, that something happens and, you know, she says, no, you know, I want him out. But here, when they're both the biological parents and you know, file under oath, and you read what the, you know, the recognition of parentage tells them, the ramifications of it, it seems to me that to somehow be able to revoke here in the face of a pending paternity action violates that injunction and makes this, you know, the rope should stand.
You have. I'm going to give you another minute because I think we gave counsel almost 3 minutes. So, and if you want to address your constitutional argument.
Well, the constitutional argument, as I said, is really gets down to what you're looking at is the substantial interest of the putative father, which here is a right to have a relationship with the child, that it's more than biological on his part. He, you know, he's willing full support, emotional, physical, et cetera. You look at the state's interest. I mean, the state's interest, I understand, is, you know, stability, et cetera, but stability isn't an important piece here when you have the paternity action filed before the adoption petition's filed. So, I mean, the state interest in stability is equally served by the fact that you can have this paternity action go forward to determine the, you know, best interests of the child with custody, et cetera. And then when you look at the third factor is any of the cost, and I'm kind of going through the Matthew factors. The cost, there isn't any cost here. You know, that the fact that you extend it beyond 30 days under these circumstances, really, when you apply the due process factors, it all fits in that there is a violation of due process, and it is to be something that this court should remedy, but need only remedy if the court decides against us on the definition of maintaining and pending, or decides against us on the rope. So it's kind of the last issue. But I think the court has to keep in mind when it's looking at interpreting the statute, that you want to interpret it to pass constitutional muster. And I think that by utilizing the definition of maintaining as we've articulated, as pending as we've articulated, it would, and that this father can proceed with his paternity action. Thank you.
Well, thank you, counsel. Excellent arguments and briefing in this matter. It's a very complex case. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory period of time.